Thank you, Joseph. Delighted to be here with you. I'm frankly a little humbled right now from the Secretary's remarks, a little bit more than I expected, so we very much appreciate it. And this is not designed to be an infomercial for the Stabilization Trust. I think the Secretary actually did that. But we want to talk to you about, from an industry and various industry perspectives, how we see this neighborhood stabilization effort going. And what can we do with the REO market and, frankly, the pre-REO market to be better? I'm going to steal a page from, I was taking notes in the back there, on what the Secretary said. You know, he used terms like market-oriented, cost-effective, strategic, and game-changing. Those are the things we need to do. That's not necessarily been the way we could characterize the first 18 months of neighborhood stabilization program. It's been a learning curve. It's been at times painfully slow learning curve with a lot of dead ends, a lot of mistakes, but a lot of valuable lessons learned. And I think, you know, I was being a little reflective back there about what a milestone this is after 18 months that, you know, HUD has obligated more than 90% of their NSP 1 funds, even though we were all fretting that this money would not get spent ever. And we were fretting that there wasn't the capacity at the local level and the connectivity between the financial community struggling with a large inventory of REO and these communities that had, frankly, lost a lot of the infrastructure to be successful. How do we solve a problem while we're rebuilding that infrastructure? So that's what we're going to talk about a little bit here today. You will not see any PowerPoints. I think this morning was appropriate for PowerPoints, all those wonderful projections and charts and trends. We're going to have a dialogue. This is a conversation. You're not going to hear me hopefully say, "And Eve, what do you think?" We want to have a conversation with you about this issue and maybe peel the onion, as they say. That's certainly our objective. We do have some very impressive panelists here. I'm going to introduce them in a minute and ask them to talk about what they do for about 3 to 5 minutes, and then we'll jump right into the sort of the conversation itself. Last thing I want to mention is we're going to go through several topics here. I want to give you a heads up of what those topics are so you can maybe frame your ideas and questions as we go. The first one will be about the broader question of how do we get to better scale in acquiring REO property? Is it first look? Is it some other approaches? How can we do this in all communities? The second question has to do with low-value properties in particular, and we're going to define that as the properties below $25,000. So it is, as some of our speakers this morning described it, a phenomenon that is particularly distressing to all of us. What do we do with that inventory? Thirdly, we're going to talk about should community buyers be in the business of looking pre-REO? What about short sales? What about other executions? Investors often are looking there first and taking the best properties before they ever matriculate through the REO process, the foreclosure process. Should we be more focused there? And then lastly, we're just going to have some summation from our panelists on how they see the next 18 months happening based upon the lessons learned to date. I hope that makes sense. I know it's ambitious, but Matt and Joseph gave us an extra 15 minutes, so maybe we can do it. Let me start by just introducing our panel, and I'm just going to mention their names and their organization and then ask each of them to maybe give us a 3 minutes on what in fact they do at their organization and how things are going today. So next to me here is Eve Montblair, who is with Chase. Next to Eve is Rob Grossinger, who already described to all of you that he's had many jobs. He can't really hold down one. Currently, he's with the Enterprise Community Partners, and it's been a month now, so things are going well. You can tell we're friends. Rob is with Enterprise, and previously, as he said, with Bank of America for many good years, very much embedded in this issue. And then Jay Ryan from Fannie Mae, who really is the key driver of their NSP and other distressed property activity. And then Terry Theologides. That's close, Terry.
Close.
It's better than the last time. With CoreLogic, the general counsel at CoreLogic, who's, and as you'll hear, CoreLogic is going to play an increasingly important role as we go forward. So let me ask you each for maybe a 3-5 minute sort of brief intro on what you do at your organization and Who wants to start?
Sure, I'll go ahead and start. So my name is Terry Theologides. I'm the GC of CoreLogic. CoreLogic was formed when First American split into the title company, and so we're now an independent company that has a lot of the data and analytics and business services assets that are not actually providing financial services or insurance or title policies. Before that, I was a general counsel at Saxon and was involved, early on in trying to get its participation up and running in the stabilization trust. CoreLogic is involved. We're not a servicer. We're involved primarily as a provider of data and services in the REO space. We have a lot of data on real property, on title, on mortgages. We have things like adjustable rate mortgage riders and data on that. And we have data on communities and on consumers. And our primary customers have been historically the private sector, but we're increasingly finding application for our data assets for community-based organizations and policymakers, and are working very closely with the Stabilization Trust to kind of repackage what we can do in a way that will allow strategic decision-making in connection with the issue that's brought us all together here today.
Great.
Jay. Ready to go? Oh, okay, hi. I'm Jay Ryan from Fannie Mae, and I'm not as bashful as Craig, so I plan to do my five-minute infomercial. And based on all the cameras in here, I think that's probably appropriate now. So I'm Jay Ryan. I do all alternative disposition sales and at Fannie. And really what that is made up of, I have a public entity sales team, which is a group that works with all the NSP grantees. They do our neighborhood stabilization efforts, and they run our Fannie Mae First Look program. I also do our rental initiatives, and we have several of those going on. I do our auction sales, and I also do our pool sales to nonprofits, to land banks, to public entities, and, of course, the dreaded investor. We do some of those. So at Fannie Mae, a while ago we made a decision we were going to put neighborhood stabilization really at the core of our REO sales efforts. Because we think selling to a homeowner is the best way to stabilize neighborhoods. And to that effort, in August of 2009, we came out with the Fannie Mae version of First Look. And in the Fannie Mae First Look, the first 15 days, 30 days in Nevada, we allow only NSP grantees and their recipients and or homeowners to purchase a property. We did it for two reasons. One is we heard a lot of concern about investors in the market, so this was designed to really move the investors back, give the homeowners and NSP grantees. The second part of it was to give them time to make offers. So earlier this year, what we did to enhance that was we enhanced our website, which is homepath.com, and you can go out there now, and for every property that we have listed that's in the First Look period, there's a First Look symbol, and it'll tell you how many days left in the First Look period. And on the website, you can download, you can put in zip codes. It's got mapping tools. You can download the information from it, and you can see really what, if you're targeting a particular area, you can target in on that, see what properties we have that meet that, and, all the information about it is available to you there. So we're very excited about our First Look efforts. Here's really the infomercial. Since August of 2009, we've sold just over 5,000 properties to NSP recipients or the grantees. So we're real excited about those numbers, and 25,000 to homeowners during that time. So we feel like it's been a good success, and we're happy with the results that we've gotten thus far. In addition to the First Look, we do a few other things. We've gone out, and I think it was Michael Schramm on an earlier panel that talked about Cuyahoga County. We've been working with Cuyahoga County now for a while, the land bank, and we've sold in four different pool transactions. I think it's about 150 properties. Each of the properties we sold for $1, and then we kicked in some additional funding to help with the demolition. So that's been a really successful, and we've also done this in Riverside County, St. Paul, Columbus. We're also working with Detroit. They're different transactions. They're structured differently. Each neighborhood has its own issues that they're dealing with or what they're trying to accomplish, and we basically open up our portfolio and stuff that's not even listed yet and say, hey, look, here's what you tell us what you're trying to accomplish. Here's our portfolio. You know, is there something we can do on a more systematic basis with you? And we think that's been we're happy with the results of that. We've also done a couple of community auctions. In those, we only allow NSP buyers to purchase during certain sessions and bid on the properties. And lastly, you know, we're also partnering with HUD on the announcement, and we're going to enhance our first look program to allow an NSP only period. So this is before we list our properties. Our first look program is on every property we list gets a first look. Before that, now before we list properties, we're going to allow NSP grantees to take a look at those properties and make an offer on them before we list out to everyone else. So we're happy to be partnering with everyone on that, and I'll stop.
Great. Well, we're going to pick up on some of those points later in terms of low-value properties and some of the other techniques that you mentioned, Jay. Rob?
Rob,
still talking to me?
Of course, always. Rob Grossinger with Enterprise Community Partners. I haven't been there long enough to even learn the elevator speech in terms of what Enterprise is, except for luckily I had been working with them for years and years and years in many different jobs that I held. My role now is to oversee the National Community Foreclosure Response Initiative, which brings together our work in our communities around dealing comprehensively with neighborhood stabilization, as well as we have a HUD technical assistance contract and work with all of our groups in those impact markets and throughout the country that are trying to do NSP. Though the name, National Community Foreclosure Response Initiative, what I've been trying to do at Enterprise, but no one will let me, is to change the title of my job to the manager of the What the Hell Do We Do Now department, because that's exactly how I feel about all this. You heard all of the discussions this morning, and it just washes over you with sort of, now what do we do? But Enterprise has been involved in this issue for a long time, and in fact, Enterprise, together with NeighborWorks and LISC and the Housing Partnership Network, came together recognizing this as a big issue and helped form the trust. And I think bringing those four entities together in and of itself was a wonderful activity for further collaboration, but also produced the trust, which then you heard. I felt like a proud father hearing all those wonderful things that the Secretary was saying. And we've since added the Urban League and La Raza as part of the sponsorship management of the trust. But so that's through that and then at the local level. But I was actually invited here in the first place back when I was at Bank of America. And then they said, oh, you can come anyway once I change jobs. At Bank of America, it was probably the week after the NSP program passed, I got a call and was told, well, you speak community development, so why don't you figure out what we're supposed to do here and just do something. We need to be able to respond to this program. We probably have to sell some REOs. We probably have to deal with community groups. So why don't you go figure out what to do? And luckily, I found a kindred spirit on the servicing side, and we created a team of nine people and began doing NSP sales to all of the NSP recipients under NSP 1 that contacted us. And, in fact, my job for a while was nobody could work with Bank of America unless they talked to me first. I didn't ask for that job. So I probably talked to literally 600 entities around the country that were using NSP funds over the 2 years that I was there after that occurred. And I will say Bank of America was doing first look directly and through the trust, but we really strongly, and I still say we because it was only 4 weeks ago, strongly supported the trust and what it was doing. So I sit here sort of with two hats, one as a former servicer and the other as a community person.
Great. Eve.
My name is Eve Mobilier. I manage Chase's Community Revitalization Program. In a nutshell, pretty much what Rob did at Bank of America, I do at Chase. We've had a community revitalization program actually before even NCST was birthed. But with the NCST coming out, what we did, we want to make it stronger, not just having a program that we may give a few properties here and there. We want to make sure that we reached out to all the community groups, both utilization of NSP and non-SP funds, one of the things that we thought about was there's a lot of organizations out there that's been historically in the game of community revitalization. They're smaller nonprofits. They don't necessarily have the capacity, both financially or staff-wise, to acquire 30, 40 units, but they may want to get one or two units. If you take a look at it, we think it's important for you to get either one unit or 100 units, because if that one unit acts as the catalyst in your neighborhood to spur community revitalization, then it makes sense. And we've done quite well. We work with the trust. They're one of great partners. Right now, our numbers are much lower than that of Fannie, but also service portfolio is less. Originally, our CEO had made a commitment that we'll move 500 units up through the end of 2010. We've bypassed those numbers. Right now, we're at 965 transactions. Of those, 414 with the NCST, and then 551 directly with Chase. But one of the most things I'm most proud about, of those 551, we've donated 282 units to nonprofits all across the country to help them in their community revitalization effort. And by doing that, we're helping them, A, the money that they make after the resale, it's an acquisition, rehab, resale program. They can in turn use it for their operational expenses. And they're also targeting low to moderate income persons. And with a donation, the acquisition costs have been brought down to zero, and it simply just becomes a rehab cost. If your rehab cost is nominal amount, even if it's 25%, but your acquisition cost is zero, now those nonprofits can go and reach out to those at the lowest economic strata and provide homeownership opportunities where none existed prior. I'll end on that.
Okay, good. So this first topic is very much in sync with what Eve was just saying. First topic is, how do we better scale and strategically acquire REO properties? And then clearly one of the things we saw at the beginning of NSP, with a concern about obligating the funds, too, and showing Congress and others that this program was necessary, was maybe taking properties willy-nilly. You know, taking a property that's available because the price was right, rather than it being in the strategically most important location. Do we feel like 18 months later that you're finding more emphasis on targeting in this NSP effort now? Do you see that from your perspective? If not, what can we do to do what the Secretary said, which is be much more strategic and game-changing with those choices? Anybody? Open it up.
I'll start with that one. We are seeing a change. One of the things, and I hate to give Craig another plug, but with the REO match, what it really does, it addresses that problem as far as housing. This is very hard work. It's scattered site, infill housing at its worst or at its best. And in order for you to really make a difference in the neighborhoods, then it's important that you just don't buy a property from Chase, though you can if you want. But you also buy properties from Wells, Bank of America, and other servicers so you can really change the demographics of the neighborhood. And at first, there was the appearance that I'm going to buy for the sake of buying. But when you buy for the sake of buying, what they were finding out, those who bought really early, was that they'll buy a property, they'll do the rehab, and then after they factor the acquisition costs and the rehab costs, they can't sell it at the market values because the market continues to go down. So that's why it makes sense for them to do strategic purchases and identify at the very earliest stage how many properties we have within a certain geography. With nonprofits historically, they've done very well in their rehab efforts, but also they've had a problem in pricing themselves out of the market. I start working in one block, and I buy one house at a time. By the time I get down to that 10th house, well, it's too late because someone else will have came and picked up the property knowing and simply watching they're doing something. Property values are going up, so let me go ahead and acquire. And that mindset has been changed where I see a lot more organizations and municipalities buying but have a strategic approach saying that we can't reverse this trend everywhere. So let us focus on core zip codes, core areas, and make changes in those areas.
Anyone else? Rob?
I would agree that REO Match has really started to get people thinking about the strategic targeting. I think also NSP2, because of its competitive nature, you're going to see that. My fear is that we'll slip back in NSP3 to the same sort of gobbledygook we had in NSP1, which is, again, as I said, I talked to probably 600 different NSP users, and I can't tell you how many conversations I had with people in which the statement was made, I just need to buy something. Just can't you just get me a property to buy? And that's my fear on NSP3. But I do think among those that were had the inclination to become strategic, they went that way.
And NSP2 is different. How so? For what reason was NSP2?
Because it was a competitive process and collaborations, and people came together. It wasn't a formulaic allocation similar to NSP1 or NSP3.
It was interesting when we were working with HUD on trying to create what we call polygons, but it's really the outlines of the target markets. It was easy for NSP2. HUD had the information. It was part of the application. Collaboration was already built into that application. But NSP1, it was arduous to try to ascertain exactly where those target markets were, how they were determined, and how they had changed over time. And it's a very good point. Jay? Terry, any other thoughts on this notion?
Well, I mean, I think you guys pretty much said it. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we saw, we talked to a lot of public entities. Like, there's like 700-800 that we've talked to because of all the subrecipients. And we ran into the same thing where they needed to buy something, or they only had enough money, they're going to buy two houses. So you really did spend a lot of time and figuring out how to sell them that one house.
Yeah.
But I think now with, you know, as we're seeing now, and I don't know if it's the deadline for NSP1 or people have, or a lot of these public entities are now much better at figuring out how they're going to execute on buying homes, that we're seeing a lot of activity. I think coupled with, you know, the Trust REO Match, we have our website now, there's REO Clearinghouse. There are ways to find all of these properties in just a few places. So I think a combination of public entities have sort of gotten up to scale. They sort of know, they sort of know how to push the dollars out to achieve what they're trying to achieve. And then there's some technology and obviously a lot more willingness among servicers, GSEs, and others to work with them.
It's one of the surprises I've had is for every Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, Mike Schrem's still here. It done all that wonderful work before anyone else on mapping where the problem properties are and how to begin to address it. For every Cleveland Cuyahoga, there were 10 communities that really weren't looking at their target market as a picture, as a chessboard, if you will, with moving parts that they needed to control in order to be effective. And so this learning process has been very surprising, at least to me. I've been in this business, as you can tell, many, many decades. That it was only when they began to have someone show the picture of where the properties are located to say, oh, I've bought 5 properties on Elm Street. It's across from the elementary school. Maybe I should buy those other 4 that are still vacant there and ascertain which seller might have those properties and are they available. So it's been almost, and I'm just speaking for myself here, not for the panel, to me it seems almost like an organic thing that sort of come to a much more sophisticated, mature view of what they're trying to accomplish as they gained experience. Would you agree?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, a precondition to even being able to have the luxury of doing that is having the basic infrastructure in place. And I think when this was starting up, you didn't, you know, how do I find out who's servicing it? Who do I talk to at the servicer? How do I get a straight answer? And I think a lot of the foundational stuff has been worked out as more and more properties have gone through the system. Not that there aren't still, you know, kinks in that process, but I think now is the opportune time to be able to make sure our efforts are being deployed most effectively by being able to not just find an REO that meets some rough guidelines, but actually being able to, you know, do what Craig is saying, map out the community, look at what properties are delinquent, what properties are vacant, what properties are underwater and appear likely to default, what's happening in that community, and then literally then, you know, develop a strategy for a particular area and then be able to drive property by property and reach out to that servicer even in the pre-REO stage to say, you know, we're doing some work, we're deploying some NSP or some public-private funds in a particular area, so that the friction, the lost productivity when properties slip out because of miscommunication or misalignment with whatever the community organization's charter or goals are or funding sources, you know, that if we can let less of that slip through our fingers by using, you know, the information earlier in the process, I think that you end up with you have the prospect of scaling this up without, you know, having to, you know, incrementally increase the effort that much.
So one of the things that I think has evolved, and this is good news, over the last, particularly the last 6 months, is a greater connectivity between, this is sort of a softball back to you, Sherry, I think, for a while it felt like the loss mitigation groups, groups that were focused on trying to keep people in homes, and those that were focused on neighborhood stabilization were like in two counter worlds. You know, there's two alternate universes, rarely talk to each other. And over time, we've seen more and more communication and connection. We now have HAFA and other efforts to work with short sale and other interim executions. And to your point, Terry, to the extent that neighborhood stabilizers are first and foremost looking to stabilize by keeping people who are in arrears in their homes in their homes as one of their first efforts, we're in better shape. And from CoreLogic's perspective, can you generate data that would help the locality see that coming?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, we can part of what we have a lot of data, and part of what our interaction with you and others is being able to understand how we make that most actionable and user friendly. Because again, we're, you know, our primary sales have been into the servicers or loan buyers or other investors who have. We understand why they wanted to understand particular characteristics of a loan or pool. And I think part of us getting to understand is what's going to be most meaningful and actionable and predictive is going to allow greater use of the data that's frankly already out there and can be, again, we're hoping to, through partnering with NCST and others, be able to make that available in a way that doesn't require us to have 800 different contracts with 800 different community-based organizations, but rather can partner with the consultative services that NCST and others can provide. I think the other, you know, big thing to recognize is that even as this gets traction, the main path, servicers for 20 years were set up to try to turn things into kind of the Adam Smith needle factory, and so there was increasing compartmentalization, just standardization. And this is, whenever we think about taking a zig or a zag in a process, we need to recognize that even if it's in everyone's economic incentives to behave a particular way, turning the aircraft carrier of a servicing operation that involves, you know, hundreds or thousands of people, well-intentioned people, is hard to do. So I think that one of the things is, as we look at adding new bells and whistles to the process, is making sure if we actually got the REO piece starting to gain traction, let's not starve that for assets, because that it is hard to layer on to an existing process something that says, well, wait, you know, I know we told you this was what you do next, but now you got to go to Eve, or you got to go to Rob, or you got to go to Jay and understand if there's a separate pathway for this property.
Craig?
Yeah.
I don't think you can possibly take into account what Terry said without understanding exactly how. Now, I don't work for Bank of America anymore, but I would have said this even when I worked there.
This is good. They can't fire you now.
Yeah, it didn't matter before, so it doesn't matter now. Mm-hmm. Without understanding exactly how difficult it is for people who have been doing the same thing for 25 or 30 years to do it differently, because it paid for their salaries and their bonuses and everything they did for all that period of time, and then all of a sudden you say to them, well, wait a minute, it's not working. For the first year that I spent with the servicing group at Bank of America, I heard that this was just a blip in the housing market, that things were going to turn around, and why should we change anything? And yes, we'll comply with HAMP, and yes, we'll comply with NSP. But you know, it's all going to come around in a year. And I thought I was living in a different world. I thought I had just entered into back the old bizarro world from where it's an alternate universe. So Terry's point about it can't be overstated. How things are done, and this was one of my biggest complaints about NSP when I was at Bank of America, is nobody brought in the servicers to talk about how they did REO, how the REO market worked, or how it was sold, or how. So that's why the 15% discount was so ludicrous at the beginning, not necessarily you could sell things at a 15% discount, but as a servicer, you can't say that publicly. You're going to get sued by your investors. And then when are you really going to get sued by your investors, or are you just using that as an excuse, which becomes a really interesting set of dialogues internally within the bank. The servicers were not at the table when the program was created. How they needed to adjust to be able to work with it, I don't even want to talk about HAMP or any of those programs, but just NSP, I think was one of the biggest misses of the NSP program. Was not having servicers who were willing to sit and show some of, unpeel the onion a little bit, and show some of how they did what they did, so that the advocates for the NSP program could say, okay, now I know how this has to work, and HUD could say, now I know how this has to work. HUD would not ask anybody to the table.
It's funny, when we made our initial contacts and negotiations with each of these good folks and other major institutions, we were using two dictionaries. We had our local housing provider dictionary where we talked about discounts, and when we went to them, we talked about concessions to price, right? Because what percentage, and you can be general if you want, but I think we talk about myths in the marketplace. One of the myths is that this Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase, Citi own most of what they service. And the reality is what?
7%.
7% you own, the
Bank
rest you're
America.
Servicing on behalf of an investor.
Right.
We own less than 30%. Yeah. But I want to just say, though, like everything new, there was a learning curve. There was a learning curve internally within all the financial institutions, with HUD, with the NSP players, because imagine all these municipalities all of a sudden, here's tens of millions of dollars, go buy houses. So it caught a lot of people off guard, and I think the program that we're seeing, that the numbers are increasing every month, but yet our inventory level, it's the lowest that it's ever been. So we are doing more with less, and that's because more parties are involved and there's understanding. Part of the challenge, and I can understand the frustration, was you must have that internal communication to where you're not working outside of the bank. So originally I had thought that, I'm the guy that gives away houses. I'm not really a banker. Well, I am a banker, but we give away houses when it makes sense to do so. It's not just a feel-good job. It's a job that's done because it's part of the community revitalization. And then getting the regular REO disposition channel involved, getting a loss mitigation guys involved, because it's easy as far as when you work with the large corporations that everyone gets funneled into their different silos. I'm only focused on what I'm doing. But I think that we've gotten much better to where we see that the community revitalization foreclosure issue is not a singular problem. It's a problem that affects all of us at all the financial institutions, because a stable community is a stable bank. And if you work for a bank, that's the focus that you have to take. And as by taking that approach, I think we're seeing a lot more success. And by also doing a lot of training with the nonprofits and the municipalities, explaining to them that we're not working against each other. We have properties. We want to move. Jurisdictions have properties that they want to buy. NSP nonprofits have properties they want to buy. It's just a matter of finding out what's the good price or discount to make it work. And I think we've been pretty successful at that, though. I think we can even be more successful with the new allocation in NSP 2 and NSP 3 and maybe NSP 4. Who knows?
Jay, I mean, Fannie is an investor. You're right on the front lines of the REO fight. You've known for your innovation at Fannie Mae and in causes like this. How do you view this, and what are the lessons learned from having evolved this over 18 months at Fannie? And I might add, Jay is very indicative of many people who now are in leading roles in the REO departments, i.e., they weren't in the REO departments before.
So, exactly. I mean, we think our servicing partners complain a lot about anything that's new. but I'm kidding. You. Yeah, you know, I know you do. No, I mean, when NSP1 first came out, we have a whole team that covers the country, that we make contact with all these public entities. I mean, they got the money. We were knocking on their door. We had the truck backed up with all of our properties ready to go. And they're basically like, there is a lead time. And the expectation that, folks who got money were going to put it out faster, which is an expectation that we had, just didn't come around. Mm-hmm. So so there was a lot of things that we did internally to match sort of, their timelines, what they were trying to accomplish. And so we really learned a lot about sort of how we needed to work with all the public entities, how we needed to work with, our other partners, throughout the process. And, I guess the unfortunate thing is NSP1 is almost done, and now we sort of have got some momentum.
Yeah.
So, so that's sort of, I guess looking back now, you could say, hey, the timeline, it took the time it took because it takes time. And, now we're sort of at the point where, there's still a lot, obviously, that can be refined. There's still a lot of ways to do it a lot better. There's still things to improve upon. But now there's, I think, a lot more tools out there. There's a lot more awareness. And I think NSP2, the money, because it's targeted, because they put in plans about how they were going to spend it, will go a lot faster. I think NSP3 will go better because, again, there's a lot more out there for folks to do. I wish it was targeted, too, but I think there's room to be helpful.
So is it fair to say that capacity has measurably improved both within the financial institutions, their REO execution, as well as at the local level with NSP providers? And that's a very general statement there. Are we really in good shape now, or are we just at the halfway mark?
It's gotten better.
Stretch that out.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to quantify saying that it's great. It's gotten better, and there's slow and incremental improvements that we have to make. I think part of it was having a better dialogue, having more focus.
People inside understand better, not just the neighborhood stabilization program, but this whole notion of community, nonprofits, and for-profit providers that are trying to work in a geographic area as opposed to the typical investor buying property?
They do, because they're not just looking at one part. They're looking at it as an aggregate. Mm-hmm. I'm often tickled whenever I go to the gym and you see that bodybuilder, which is not me, but you see that bodybuilder working out in that one part. Does it have tremendous, huge torsos, and then they have little skinny spaghetti legs? I look at that, it's like, aren't you paying attention to the rest of you? But I guess they just always wear jeans when they're out and just look buffed. I work on my legs, so that's why
you're
I tell
bring
people.
This back to REO?
Yeah. And the reason I bring it back to REO
you
is...
You get me a little concerned, that's all.
Is that you have to pay attention, because a lot of people, they don't pay attention. They simply look at that, if I'm going to display just this portion, that's all I need to work in. And you can't. You have to look at a comprehensive model. So I think internally at Chase, we've had internal trainings with our partners about what's the process. I don't get calls any longer asking me, so what is it that you do? They already know. And then we work together, try to show them, how can we make it all work? It's not just with the REO guys, it's also with the lending. Because someone has to be out there providing financing for these properties after they've been acquired in rehab. So we have a dialogue with them. So I keep going back to the dialogue, because I think it's important, but you must have that smooth communication where everybody knows what's going on to some degree, because if you don't, then you're going to have that pushback as to, we don't know what you're doing, so we're going to stay here in our silo, and you can't be like that for this to be successful.
Yes, good point.
Please read Terry's piece in the brochure, in the booklet. Actually, it's a very nice booklet. You have to understand the economics of servicing, especially when it comes to REOs and asset disposition. What's harder is to understand how servicers are really constructed and how things really work and what their partnerships with real estate agents on the ground are and what real estate agents' relationships with other people on the ground are. until you have a full picture of this, and Terry's piece is wonderful in terms of letting you understand exactly.
Did you read mine?
I know there are other ones in there.
All the pieces are wonderful. One of the wonderful pieces is Terry's. You need to know what costs stay with the servicer, what they can pass on. I used to have these conversations with Craig a long time ago in which he would be talking about the money he would save me, and I would say, not my problem. I pass that on to the investor. There's a lot of policymakers here, but for those of you that really want to get underneath this issue, you've got to understand what the other side is doing and how they're doing it. And so you have to read all the wonderful pieces and Terry's piece, and you have to learn how servicers do this nuts and bolts. Otherwise, they're not going to tell you because they're just not.
We spend a lot of time on something called the net realizable value. Many of you have heard it. You know, how can you, if you know what your time on market for property is and you take into consideration the property taxes you pay, the insurance, the security costs, the marketing costs, the rehab costs, vandalism, all the different costs that some are known and some are, you know, are just hopes. But you know there are a lot of inherent costs the longer you hold the property. And if you could get a quick and certain sale, wouldn't that motivate you to sell at a good concession price? He said, only if I could find a way to defend myself to the investor. He said, why did you sell that property so quickly? You must have sold it at too dear a price. So we're in a world here where everybody's learning, including the investor. And I'm not really referring to Fannie Mae that totally gets this. I'm talking about the many investors that you do, right, Jack?
Yeah. Yeah, the first time I went to committee with selling properties for a dollar.
Yeah, that must have been a pleasant discussion.
It was a fun discussion, but we prevailed.
So is that the biggest myth, really, that has permeated in this first 18 months around the sale of property, that the investor really is the one that's driving a lot of the decisioning for all of us? Or are there some others that you really think have been, as you look back, sort of the biggest challenges that we have overcome as an industry? And I'm talking about a collective industry here, whether you're an academic or a local housing provider or you're a financial institution. What are those biggest barriers that we've now actually overcome? That's a simple question.
I would say that the operational barriers are the ones that are tough and less susceptible to kind of a silver bullet. I think that and I appreciate the comments about my paper, but part of what I try to do is think of every question I'd ever gotten from community-based organizations about, well, why can you do this? Why can't you do that? And try to write it all down, write all the answers down. But I think that the investor side, and I don't speak about Fannie and Freddie now, my experience is more with securitized, you know, Alt-A and subprime, this is non-agency, ABS. If the servicer can figure out that they, you know, can with a straight face say that my actions are actually in the best interest of the trust that owns this loan, they can probably get there. There's some arcane tax, you know, things and other things that could preclude certain options. But basically, that was a big issue, but it was one that got overcome in the first month or two when we, you know, sat down and I and along with every other general counsel of a servicer analyzed this program and said, son of a gun, it works. If you can sell it faster by providing a first look, it's going to save you the carry, it's going to save you the maintenance costs, the cost of insuring and all these other things, the costs attendant to further diminution of value of that property if it's in a declining market, son of a gun, we can get there. That was, I think, the easier question. I think the tougher one is then, you know, is operationally when all your processes and forms are designed to provide consistency and a standard routine, you had to essentially, you know, bypass that artery because there was no way you could, you know, reprogram that entire process in a timely fashion. And I think that that's so today it's not that every manager of REO at a servicer, at least in my experience, has been retrained to understand how to give a first look or whatever. you've tried to just bolt into a process before it even gets to the REO manager, some automated way to extract some properties from the queue that meet whatever guidelines are coming from whatever community-based organizations or through whatever conduit or intermediary. And then if those don't pass, don't get taken up in the first look, they come back into the queue. And frankly, everyone else is just generally aware from their newsletter or from the intranet site about what great things are being done, but it hasn't necessarily changed their process. And I think that as we think about how to start to now take advantage of the fact that some pre-foreclosure properties may be eligible for some of this money, again, we need to think about how we can essentially snip the artery, put in a little bypass mm-hmm. process, usually run by someone like, Jay, Rob, or Eve, that get it and have a broader vision of what's going on, and then funnel it right back into the cookie cutter approach.
But I would say, from our perspective, I mean, price and process were probably the biggest obstacles for us initially. When we foreclose on a property, I mean, we have all of our systems are designed, and all of our processes and all of our folks are designed. You get it in through foreclosure. You do everything you need to do to the property in terms of repair or whatever and maintenance of the property. You get it with one of our brokers. You get it listed. You get it sold. I mean, it just runs along. So everything that my group does is counter to that. Mm-hmm. And you have to pull stuff, off the, off conveyor the belt right. to do it. And then you have to justify price or others why that makes sense for the company. And you add on top of that, we're in conservatorship. You have to explain to your conservator why it makes sense for us, who's trying to conserve assets, to pull those assets off the conveyor belt as you go along. So part of it, and I know that's just our institution. I'm sure other investors have different issues. But
it's a very common one, though, Jay. I think the way you've approached it is a very similar one. Some use their regular REO stuff, but most of them, Eve and certainly at Bank of America, where Rob was, and Wells Fargo, they have a specialty unit now that's understanding NSP. They've been trained in it. They know what to expect, and it's made it a lot easier. The other thing that we haven't mentioned before we get off this first notion of scale and strategy is, first look, whether it's our first look or just, anyone's first look, part of the premise is not only the quick and certain sale to a ready and willing NSP buyer, it's that we're using an opportunity while the servicer and manager of that property is getting a property ready for sale, say in that first 15, 20 days after it first falls into their REO lap, while they're getting ready to sell it, we're using that time to inform the local player and get them to determine whether that's a property that might be of interest to them. So there's no lost time. The key there is it has to, at the end of the day, for any of us, be a sustainable proposition, and sustainability means win for the seller as well as the buyer, and ultimately for that investor that you have to answer to as the servicer.
Just so that people understand the investor side of things, Bank of America services on behalf of 700 different investors. So, and they don't speak with one voice. And even though our general counsel can occasionally make a decision based on the delegated authority that the servicer has and what is in the best interest of the investor, it gets very complicated. I mean, let's face it, our society created a home finance structure that only a nightmare could create. And so that it just makes things more difficult.
I've had it referred to as Byzantine, which I think gives me an advantage to actually understand.
Well, I'm gonna turn that before we move on to the low value property question. I want to open it up here to see if there's one or two questions from the audience on this notion, these broader questions that we've been discussing. Yes, Frank.
Frank Ford, Neighborhood Progress, Cleveland, Ohio. Could one of the panelists, maybe Rob in particular, clarify a little more of the use of the term investor? And I want to give you an example to ground this. If we have a property in Cleveland and the mortgage is held, I'm going to make this up, say it's held by Citibank, trustee for the XYZ service loan pool. Let me continue with the scenario. So the mortgage is held by Citi. Well, the mortgage is held by Citi, trustee, but then it's serviced by, I'll make this up to Wells Fargo. In that scenario, when you say the word investor, are you referring to who represents? It's the trust, right?
Yes.
Is the investor. But then is the trust represented by city as the trustee, or is there somebody else we should be talking to here?
It depends
and
on the
Rob, before you answer, I just advise, this is also being webcast, and it's not coming across clearly, so if we can speak into our microphone.
But it says, please do not adjust your microphone.
I know. Well, just lean forward.
The trustee represents, in most cases, yeah. Those are going to be either be mortgage-backed securities or collateral debt obligations. So the trustee represents that. Then you have aggregators. So Bank of America services mortgage-backed securities that are owned by Wells Fargo. So in that, there's an example. So in that case, right. Wells Fargo is the investor. But there may be a separate trustee that holds the paper. Remember, the trustee is just this, it's sort of like in that Indiana Jones movie when he shows up and there's some guy guarding the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. It's just somebody who sits there and says, I'm holding all these papers and don't bother me. Cleveland's the only place that's actually done a good job of getting those folks to
except
pay attention.
That in Cleveland, because in Ohio, because their name's on the deed, we are going to hold them accountable.
Right.
You know, part of the announcement today, and the secretary didn't mention it, but part of it, Frank, is to we've gotten a lot of the big trustees to sign up to be part of First Look Now and disclose a lot more information as part of this effort, Deutsche Bank, U.S. Bank, and Wells Fargo. So I think that's going to be a positive step as well. One more question. Over here in the back.
Hi. Shaheen Asiripour. I'm a reporter with the Huffington Post. I actually had a quick question. Terry, you mentioned how well, the First Look program is working. I'm curious to know, given the ills of the housing market, home prices are forecasted to decline anywhere from 7% to 15% over the next year or two. Given the, you know, the relative lack of funds that have been devoted to NSP and the money that's been devoted to programs like HAMP and others, and how well or how poorly those other programs have worked out, I'm curious to know if folks on the panel think that perhaps more money should be given to this First Look program. That perhaps it's best to just kind of clear folks out of these homes and get them into the hands of folks who can afford to live in them.
You know, I'll start because I'm the moderator. I can do that. You know, I think you're going to hate the answer because the answer is it depends. But it really does depend on the locality and how they choose to implement the program, how strategic their targeting is, and how thoughtful that effort is. So we do have communities across the country, and HUD knows this and they're working on it, that have literally bought stuff in a very large zip code size area. And guess what? At the end of the day, that $20 million can't be seen. Maybe it'll be seen later, but it really isn't reversing a trend. And then there are others, and Rob, you live in one of these cities, that have done incredibly if the city of Chicago can maintain the discipline of picking very tight target markets, we have a much greater likelihood of success. The secretary mentioned Minneapolis. They get started. One of the reasons they often get heralded is not only do they have a very good collaborative public-private effort there, but they get started a year before everybody else. They had non-NSP money that they started with, tens, $15 million. And they now have neighbors, there's a report on this, they now have neighborhoods on the north side of the city that are where property values have restabilized and are beginning to tick up and where the demand for housing has changed fundamentally. So it really, in my opinion at least, depends on how we use the money. And the good news is there are more communities smartly using that money today than there were 18 months ago.
And I think a smart use of the financial resources is the ability to leverage those funds. If you receive $2 million from NSP and you only use $2 million to do acquisition, rehab, and resell, then you haven't really leveraged it. Those that are most successful are able to leverage it anywhere from a 2, 3, or maybe a 4 to 1, and then that creates more funds in place.
Other thoughts? Rob, any more on the Chicago experience? Because it really is one of the better models for a disciplined, targeted approach, even though in the early months there was a lot of angst that, gee whiz, we're not seeing many properties.
Right. Just to build on that, remember the timing of this. So NSP passed in 2008. In December of 2008, with a sort of a nudge from Treasury, all the major servicers stopped doing foreclosures in respect of the holidays, and then that continued on all the way till the May of the next year. It was a long holiday season. So there really were very few foreclosures at all being processed by the major servicers into the middle of 2009. Then, lo and behold, HAMP said, well, if anyone's applied for HAMP, you can't do a foreclosure until you've taken them all the way through. And by the way, no matter what, you can't do a declination letter until the end of the year. So 2009 was almost a wasteland for foreclosures with respect to the major servicers. So when I started working on NSP with Bank of America, the REO portfolio was X. At the beginning of 2010, March of 2010, it was less than half of X. So it had really dropped because of that.
Yeah,
so,
same for you, too, are you afraid?
Absolutely.
But with respect to Chicago, what happened is, and this is part of what I think is where we all have to go in terms of comprehensive neighborhood revitalization and stabilization, not just REO, and it's not just a transaction discussion. Chicago had already committed through a large grant from the MacArthur Foundation and a city agreement to target 16 neighborhoods for revitalization. And so they just overlaid the NSP program on top of those 16 neighborhoods and said, we're only going to transact NSP business within these particular neighborhoods. And it drove Craig crazy because he'd be showing and showing properties and they go, nope, not on the wrong street, nope, wrong street, nope, wrong. But they stayed pretty true to it. So now they've been able to build up a lot of momentum. They're also looking at some multifamily strategies. You heard today, this morning, a lot of discussion around the 2 to 4. The other issue in Chicago are the 6 to 25 unit properties. There's a lot of those sized apartments that are struggling or going vacant because you lose 3 or 4 tenants there and your cash flow goes out the window. So Chicago was disciplined, contrary to everything you see on the news about Illinois and Chicago. We are disciplined on corruption, too. So to that extent, I think they've really done themselves a service by staying true to those 16 neighborhoods, because those neighborhoods are also getting infrastructure help. They're getting help with the schools. They're getting help with other types of community development funding. So it makes it much more the long-term strategy for those neighborhoods is much brighter than if you simply looked at only those neighborhoods where there was high foreclosures and a lot of vacant properties. Some of those are being triaged out, quite honestly.
So we're going to move on, but just one or two more questions on this broader topic. I think Frank had a question. There's a question over here in the corner when we start with my esteemed colleague, Frank.
Frank Alexander with the Center for Community Progress. I confess I'm puzzled by what the panel, all of y'all, have said in some ways. I don't think you're confronting the dilemma with getting this to scale.
Let's go to the question over here.
Stick to your plan.
Let me phrase it a series of very precise questions. Terry, perhaps you can help us. What percentage of completed foreclosures become REO? And how has that changed over the past 12 months? If it hasn't changed, why haven't the servicers begun to revise their bidding policies at the auctions or the foreclosure sales? Which ultimately leads to the question of, isn't the main problem now in getting this to scale the PSA? What, Rob, you were alluding to, the 700 different servicers or different investors, that unless and until we break apart the PSAs or find a new way of doing it, we can't take this to scale.
Mm-hmm. Question.
I don't know if I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that REO volumes went down during this period for a variety of factors that, related more to the moratoria and the lengthening of the foreclosure process. I think we're starting to see REO volumes start to tick up. I don't know that I attribute that slowdown in the process to anything inherent. The PSAs haven't changed during that process. The pooling and servicing agreements will yield, if there are foreclosures, some of them, the majority of them are going to go to REO. Now, some servicers are changing their bidding policies and trying to encourage more, bidding so that you get more third-party bids. Some are obviously focused on pre-foreclosure efforts like short sales and things like that. But I don't think the scalability factor will be a shortage of, you know, of REO. At the end of the day, many of those foreclosures that are going to end up as REO, and the PSA, again, there's variations, but by and large, and I've looked at, you know, dozens and dozens, probably over 100 PSAs, I think that they permit a first look program along the lines of what's been decided. Why? Because it's a wasting asset. It's an asset that you're having to advance principal and interest on to your investor, and you're having to advance all of the carry costs, the maintenance, and the preservation costs. And if you can yield something better now and ultimately sell it for something that is a discount to what you'd have to sell it, you know, or try to sell it for later to end up in the same place, you can get there on it. So I think that I think as people figure out whether a securitization market is going to come back, you got to figure out what to do and how to structure that. And big issue, a very, very important issue. But I wouldn't I don't see the PSA structure as the major impediment to scalability. I think by and large a servicer, at least for the REO, can operate within this construct. And as I said before, I think that the operational constraints are the ones that are probably more of a challenge about executing it. That, my two cents.
If I had a whiteout, there's part of the PSA I'd probably white out, but I think for me there's two reasons why it's hard to get to scale. First, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but $7 billion is a drop in the bucket. And second, there's no demand out there. So for all the houses that get rehabbed that you try and resell, especially in the hardest hit communities, there's nobody to buy them. Until we come up with a targeted, affordable mortgage product which takes into account that pendulum swing that's made credit so tight right now, bring it back into the middle, there's going to be that demand, the lack of demand, is going to kill everything we try and do in a lot of these neighborhoods. And you can't get to scale when there's no end game for those properties.
It's probably... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and you know, we made a conscious decision. I mean, we don't, if we don't do a short sale, if we don't do a some sort of modification or workout, we don't do a short sale. We want it to go through foreclosure. We don't want a lot of bidding on the courthouse steps, because who's buying on the courthouse steps? It's investors, and if we make it easier for investors to purchase there, it sort of goes around our first look program or anyone else's first look program. So. You know, so that's sort of how we're operating now.
Eve?
Yeah. Initially, we didn't have participation in the first look with investor-owned units, but after much nudging from the NCST, we've included that part of the portfolio into it, so you have just the regular Chase-owned and the investor-owned units as well that's out there. I think we also have to really just open the dialogue around, when we talk about community revitalization, we often just focus on REO and REO acquisition, whereas community revitalization also means that we're doing our great effort in the front end in preventing foreclosures through loss mitigation strategies. And I think all the servicers, they've gotten much better in their loss mitigation strategies, techniques, addressing the issue. And the more success on that front, the less success you'll have in the available units as they come into REO.
You know, just back to, and I think Rob mentioned this, $7 billion sounds like a lot until you start doing the math. I think we did the calculation, $4.5 billion to just do the city of Chicago at one point. You know, at the end of the day, you're absolutely right, Frank, that that's an important issue. But I worry more that if we for me, and I look at Matt McCarthy's over there, and he would say this much more effectively than I will. But, you know, I think we just have to be thoughtful about how we use limited resources. And to Eve's point, if we think NSP $7 billion is going to solve the problem, we're delusional. If we think that might be catalytic, that we get back to the notion that the public sector should be a catalyst to reengage the engines of the private sector, we at least have a shot. We have to reform the private sector, the way things are done. But we're in a position now where We've got loose targeting. We've got very little interim financing or permanent affordable financing available for new buyers. And we haven't thought enough about neighborhood confidence and how to rebuild the confidence in where people live. And if you don't do all those things, the $7 billion, even if you had $70 billion, might not be successful. Don't end on a down note. One last question here in the back over there, and then we're going to move on to low-value property.
I'll try to make this quick. David Noguera with HUD. This is actually a question for Rob. Rob, you spoke about the disconnect between NSP grantees and servicers and the fact that because the grantees didn't understand the servicer process, it kind of slowed things down with being able to access the properties. Looking at some of the work that Stabilization Trust has done and Fannie Mae as they've sort of set up some infrastructure to assist grantees, I'm wondering if you think there's more that's needed to bridge that gap between the grantees and the servicers, or have entities like this trust and Fannie sort of fill that void?
Well, you know, not everyone goes through the trust, first of all, and I think that's, you know, we encourage, I know Chase encourages, I know the other, I don't work for Bank of America anymore, do I? They encourage, Chase encourages to work with the trust. The biggest disconnect, truthfully, was even though we set up, I'm going to say we, I can't help it, we set up a separate staff to do all NSP sales to anyone who's using NSP money, we still every day found out that NSP grantee, and I went on this national, Craig knows, we were everywhere together, trying to tell everybody, please come to me. In fact, they joked that the Bank of America program was 1-800-CALL-ROB. And yet, every day, NSP recipients would go to the local real estate agent and say, hi, I'm here with NSP money. You got to give me a 15% discount. I want to buy this house. And the real estate agent would say, get out of here. So, because we couldn't educate 5,000 real estate agents. We tried once, and all that happened was every one of them called me and said and yelled at me because they didn't get enough listings from Bank of America, and they wanted some of that NSP money for themselves. So we had, actually had to send out a hotmail to all 5,000 saying, please don't call Rob anymore. So that, I think, was the biggest one, is no matter how we tried, and I'm sure this was true for most of the major servicers, to let every NSP recipient know either that there was a separate process or go through the trust, they still would go to the local real estate agents and get frustrated because in that world, they're going to lose 99% of the time.
You know, at the end of the day, and this will sound like an infomercial, I don't mean it to be, but the end of the day, on all the transactions we've done, we're still averaging more than a 15% discount per property. But it wasn't that we started by saying we need a 15% discount. We the quick and certain sale derives a certain result. We're going to move on to low-value properties here. It's a very important issue. We have some very important speakers on this issue today and tomorrow as well in other panels. But low-value properties are getting more attention from the financial community. They're trying to figure out ways to do something that is more systematic, and it certainly is a big issue in some communities. And before we jump into it, I do want to shout out to Heidi Coppola that's here somewhere. Where are you, Heidi? Because the REO Clearinghouse is really specialized in this. There's Heidi in Cleveland and other markets and done a really more on-the-ground effort than the trust has ever been able to do and successfully. How big is this low value? And I defined it as below 25,000 property arbitrarily, but is this a widespread national problem, or is this something we see in certain markets, perhaps in the Midwest and other places? Let's start there.
Yes.
I know it's big in terms of visibility and vulnerability, but in terms of number of properties. Sense of it? Terry, are you in a...
You know, I should know the data, but my impression, but I haven't really looked at it closely, is that it's much more sort of localized. That in some markets, it's not so much an issue, and in some markets, it's the major mm-hmm. issue.
I mean, I would say from I don't have any numbers on it from our portfolio. We have low value properties, you know, everywhere. So it must be a national problem. But I mean, clearly it's concentrated. You know, there's a lot in you know, Ohio, Michigan, in places like that. And in there, you know, because it's concentrated, it's that much harder to figure out exactly what to do. And you know, the one thing we know about low value properties is they don't improve with age. So, you know, you need you know, you need to get in there and you need to have a strategy. You need to be working with them because they go down faster in value the longer they sit. So
it's not till this moment, Jay, that I realize that I have something in common with low-value properties. So is this a conundrum that's unsolvable? Because as a servicer, as an investor, a low-value property, you're not going to get back much of what the original investment was. And to matriculate that through the foreclosure process to the time it becomes REO means you lose even more money. What's our option here? If you have the answer to that one, we can just close the conference as successful.
Yes.
Can we come up with common protocols among the financial institutions that at least help? Rob, part of what I see is there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding out there about what can be done. How many charge-offs are there? Is everyone walking away from these assets?
Well, because that's not something anyone's going to ever tell you the truth. Anyone on this panel that says they'll tell the truth about it is not telling the truth.
I'll tell the truth.
I don't even believe you. here's the hard part of sizing this. So X number of the servicers will say, and the trust and a number of the major servicers met in Dallas. Danny Gardner, I think, facilitated this meeting. And I think Heidi was there to talk about low-value properties. And everyone gave their numbers. But that's based on the REO population that you've done a valuation for. If 3 times, 5 times, 7 times as many properties are sitting in pre-foreclosure that are either now abandoned or soon to be abandoned, and I want to give you one other statistic, which is horrifying, and you don't know what the value of those are, then how do you know what your low-value property population is? You only know as a servicer what you've done a recent appraisal on, and those are the REOs or gotten a BPO. You have no clue what's sitting in your pipeline. You have no clue what that value is unless you make it up or basically you try to turn the other way. But here's an interesting thing we found out. It's nowhere near as sophisticated as Terry, but we did a pilot project with a group in Chicago, and we asked them to go knock on the doors of 500 borrowers who were 60 days or beyond delinquent in a particular zip code, one zip code. Bank of America and Countrywide had actually 1,000 borrowers in that one zip code who were 60 days or beyond delinquent, but a number of them were either in bankruptcy or there were reasons that knocking on their door wouldn't have worked, or we knew the property was vacant. Of those 500, another 100 turned out to be vacant that we didn't know about. 150 people were living there who had no either a relationship but no legal relationship to the ownership of the property. It was the cousin or the daughter or the ex-wife or the son or the friend who said, I'm allowed to, such and such told me I could live here. So the owner was long gone. Somebody was occupying the property, not paying anything. It was a great deal for them, but they had no relationship. So there's no loan modification in the world that works for somebody who's not on the loan. And when we were done knocking on all 500 doors, 230 were owner-occupied that might be able to get a loan modification. And when they went through, the group went through and did all of the work with them, 100 actually got loan modification. So it was a great percentage of those that were eligible or were owner-occupied. But how many of those did no one have a clue about in terms of their legal status or what was going to happen to them, nor if they were low value or not, because there had been no valuation?
Jay, point, counterpoint.
He doesn't believe anything I'm going to say, so I don't know if it's worth going through.
Go ahead, Jay.
Okay, thank you. So, I mean, look, on low value, it's very tricky. So, you know, we've been trying to do a bunch of different things. You know, I talked about Cuyahoga County. I talked about different things. So, you know, if you're talking 25 and below, which in some parts of Cleveland or Detroit may not be low value. It depends on what market you're in. And that's not any type of slight. We do some customized transactions with folks. You know, we're looking to really figure out, you know, how we can, you know, sell these properties as quickly as possible to folks who are responsible. And, you know, in that mix, you know, we do sell to private investors. And one of the things that we have done, and I think I've talked about this before on some other panels, is basically we screen all of our investors. We have a bunch of folks that come to us, private investors who have tons of money, who want to buy all these properties. You know, we'll buy everything at 40 cents on the dollar and take this away from you. And we haven't done that. So we screen them. We figure out what they're going to do, what their strategy is ultimately for disposing of the properties. You know, we have a bunch of restrictions in the sale agreement we have with them, so they can't flip it for 90 days. And then only a very, very small percent, I think it's 10%, in the next year. So when they're buying our properties, they know they have to hold on to them. They know they have to have a strategy to deal with them. And in some cases, we've even taken those investors. You know, we took one to the city of Detroit, and they basically said, you know, we like his plan. We like what he's doing. You know, we're fine with you working with that investor. We did it with Chicago also. We've done it with some other places. So there is that strategy. You know, we're going to have more properties that are low value coming through REO. It's going to be hard to keep up with that volume. You know, I think, you know, if you go to the other side, sort of pre-REO, you want to keep people in their homes. You can't keep people in their homes. You know, you can't do a short sale. You know, then you try the deed in lieu. You can't do that. Then, you know, if you have a property that's vacant, and I think one of the things that we're, you know, you don't have a homeowner in there. I mean, one of the things that you know, we think would be helpful is you move it through as quickly as possible at that point. If you have a vacant property, we don't like to rush foreclosures when someone is in there. We don't like to, you know, talk about that in these kind of settings. But if you have a vacant property, again, it's not going to get any better if it sits longer. You get that through, and at least you get it into, away from the servicers, who really don't, we're not interested in servicing it, you know, into the investors' hands, in this case ours, and then we can figure out much sooner in the process how we can dispose of this asset in the best way possible.
So purgatory doesn't serve anyone's needs. If it's just sitting there vacant and it's not even in the foreclosure process, then
again, because really we don't have, and a lot of times we don't have a good picture into what that looks like.
Yeah.
We don't have a good picture into sort of, you know, we don't even know if there's someone in there in some cases. We don't know if, you know, if it's
so
a homeowner.
Jay, I'm going to stick with you a minute here because you mentioned earlier the bulk sale that you've done, and if I don't ask this question, Frank Ford will. But you've done some really exciting bulk transactions of very low-value property in Cleveland. You mentioned you're looking at some other markets. I guess I have a two-part question, part for you and part for the others. Is that scalable? I mean, when we're dealing with REO that has little or no residual value, can we look to see more bulk, generous, shouldn't even use that term, it's a pejorative term, more no-cost or low-cost bulk transfers in the marketplace? And we'll start with you, Jay, because you've done it. Maybe you could describe how it worked, and then I'd like to ask the others.
So, I mean, I'll just use Cuyahoga County. So we'd been working with them a while, and actually P.J. McCarthy, who's here, he's based in Cleveland, and he did most of the work that I'm going to take credit for. But he did, we worked with him for a while. And really what we found, and I don't want to use the term generous, I don't want to use any of those terms. I mean, we think, you know, that was the best, result for us.
Yeah.
The land bank thought it was the best resolution for them. So, I mean, I think part of this is getting that kind of, you need to figure out, again, price. What really makes sense, and how can you then, because otherwise you're not going to be able to scale, because every time you're going to go in there and you're going to have to, you know, figure out, okay, I got this kind of, you know, these properties, does that make sense? So we set up a template with them. We set up a standard document, and then basically we show them a list of, you know, anywhere from 20 to 50 properties or so that they take a look at, they do their due diligence on, and most of them, are going to be scheduled for demolition in this pilot. Some, if they're going to rehab, they'll note those. But it's a standard process. I don't know if it's scale. Doing 150 really isn't scale. It takes a lot of time and work and effort. But now we've done four. We're doing our next one. And then so each one we've done. Columbus, we set up a different one. Again, these are lower value properties. We're not selling them for a dollar. They have different plans for those properties. You know, we've gone to St. Paul, Riverside. It's a newer housing stock. They weren't going to demolish these properties. They were going to put a lot of the money, NSP money, into rehabbing them really doing a lot more than we would ever do on the rehab or to sell the properties so that they could sell to first-time home buyers. So, you know, again, in each of those places, you know, we have, again, a template. Mm-hmm. We can show properties. They can decide which ones they want to take. And then the pricing, the documents are all there so that, you know, it can become, I don't like to use the word scalable, but it's certainly replicable.
As Chase looked at this, Eve, I mean, can you see down the line a time when we would have a much more predictable process in place with the larger financial institutions? You can't speak for all the financial institutions, but what do you think?
Well, it's currently under assessment. We've done one large transaction with Hands of Central New Jersey where they were able to purchase 47 distressed notes from us outside of Hands. Now there's New Jersey Community Capital. They've stepped to the plate, and they're also working with us and trying to get some additional acquisitions. The question really that I'll ask and then answer thereafter is, if you find yourself in a position that it's prom time and no one wants to take you, you have to go find a cousin. But what happens if you don't have a cousin? Okay, and I restate it in saying that a lot of dialogue has been going on about low-value properties, but the cities don't want the low-value properties either. Because if you get a low-value property, you do the rehab, then you can't really resell it because who's going to do financing on a $25,000 property? So it's a problem that's circular, and we're trying to figure out what would be the most streamlined process to where we can identify a value. And that's all over the map, because one area may be $25,000 in California. Well, that's not even a closet, so maybe $100,000. So it varies. But once we've identified and we come up with a uniform standard for a property that's deemed low value, what would be the disposition method? Who is willing to step up to the front and say that I'll take these low value properties, do the appropriate rehab, find a home buyer or tenant, and make it work? Anybody?
Frank.
we're gonna talk, Frank.
Rob, any thoughts here?
Well,
since you're absolved of guilt for what you say.
Yeah. I don't. Low value has one description that I think is sort of general, people understand. I think of it as negative equity. So if a and again, I'm going to point back to Terry's piece. Of all of the wonderful papers for this, take a look at his analysis of why a servicer might choose to charge off, release the lien, and walk away. And it's not an evil choice. It's an economic choice, and it has to do with what can be pushed up to the investor and what has to be eaten by the servicer. It's a very economical choice, sometimes almost a necessity. So those are the negative equity properties, where even if you went through foreclosure, took title, and then tried to dispose of it in any way, shape, or form, you have already lost money. You have spent more money going through that process than what you could ever get in terms of a disposition strategy. Those types of properties are going to grow. And the question is, how do municipalities, how does the nonprofit world, how do people who care about their neighborhoods start to deal with those properties? I do want to say, with respect to that issue, every once in a while you get lucky, and so because of Jay and because of PJ, didn't mean to rhyme. You know, I don't think Fannie wasn't looking at this issue and thinking, maybe we need to start doing the charge-offs and walk away. But these guys, that wasn't going to happen, not on their watch. And I think what's happened in Cleveland and what they've done is both a testament to their fortitude, but also their vision about what an entity like a servicer can and can't do. Private label investors being serviced by servicers, you don't necessarily have the same leeway. I'm curious about the note sale. Were those your notes or were those investor notes?
Ours.
All right. Yeah. Then you got to take on this whole other question.
But would it not be at least better to have more consistent protocols among the financial institutions as to how they process a low-value property? Right now we have every institution is struggling with it. And one of the reasons we had that meeting in Dallas was we found that there are wide discrepancies, not that one's right and one's wrong, but wide discrepancies in how they look at low-value property, how they process them, what the decision points are. And maybe if we could have a little bit more of a transparent process, we could be a little bit further down the line, and it could be more predictable for the ultimate potentially willing buyer.
As Rob, I'll go ahead.
Harry.
Go ahead.
I want to hear about your case.
No.
I'll change.
No, I mean, I think I do think this is one, if not the toughest, one of the toughest challenges. And to Frank's point earlier, I do think this is where the flaws or the, you know, where the PSAs become an impediment. Again, I think that you know, there's probably going to be there are plenty of REO and properties. And probably most properties don't fit into this category, but this is the most perhaps intractable challenge. And the PSA, if you're not Fannie Mae and if you're a servicer hired, you know, on fixed compensation with fixed authority, if you end up being upside down, essentially, if the advances that you've had to make during delinquency of principal and interest, if the costs to carry that, and your anticipated rehab or code remediation or other costs upon taking title will far exceed not just represent 100% loss, but actually amplify the loss for the investor that hired you. That, you know, that investor, you know, contractually could say, give me that money back. Why did you throw good money after bad? And so that's a real challenge. I think what happens is the servicer has to be very vigilant earlier in the process and look at whether they can do a one-off sale of a note or do other things to accelerate the process. I think it's hard to replicate in a large scale what note owners or what, you know, I mean, Fannie can do it in a large scale, but I think that's an area where it really is going to be a challenge to figure out a systemic way to deal with the low value properties in the ABS securities.
Look, the economics are, it's always better to charge off and walk away in most, you know, if you have a low value property. It's not a hard economic analysis to do that. You know, what I would say, and is true, We were doing some charge offs. We stopped that earlier in the year or last year. We don't do them anymore. And look, you know, the people inside, of Fannie were like, well, look, I can show you the numbers. It does not make sense to not charge off. And you know, but we stopped it. So that's another reason we're going to have more low value REO properties coming through. But you know, the reason that what we've told people and what we're trying to do now is build a waterfall to say, look, it's not the charging off. I mean, you can charge off, you know, anything. It's an accounting entry. You know, you just basically, you know, you write off the investment. Mm-hmm. You can't just walk away from it. So you got to kind of delink the charge off and the walking away. You could charge it off and say, hey, I'm going to give this property, you know, I'm going to knock on the door and give them back, you know, I'm going to give them title to the property free and clear. And in some cases, the property is in fine shape, and the borrower can actually handle that. And you know, resolve. That's one down. But you can't. You have to make sure that title doesn't remain clouded, and that property just doesn't sit. So you know, we're looking at different ways and folks we can partner with to figure out how we can address that. So that if we do decide that, you know, we'd rather not take it into REO because it's, you know, again, it's not getting better with age. We can deal with it up here. Are there opportunities to then make sure that if we have very low value properties that we can responsibly either give it back to the borrower in the cases that work, or give it to another entity that's going to sort through it and figure out how to clear up the title, maintain the property during the time it is doing this, and other things. So, I mean, charge offs are happening. We have 2 minutes remaining.
Yeah, I'm gonna. I was waiting for you to take a breath, Jay.
Yeah.
So we have other questions, and we're almost out of time. So I'm going to ask the panel to do something difficult, which is to put in a sentence the answer to this last two questions. The first one has it. I teased everybody here by the pre-foreclosure issue. What do we do about getting to property earlier in the process? If each of you could just comment in one sentence. Is looking at property pre-foreclosure sale, such as short sales, an illusion or a necessary reality for buyers going forward with NSP? Eve? I know the answer, too, so I'm just going to grade you on.
It's a necessary reality, but we still haven't ironed out the kinks to make it work.
Good sentence. Rob?
Agreed.
Is that a sentence?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has a period after it.
All right. Jay. Yeah, I mean, I agree. We need to figure out a way to do that. I mean, but you think about a short sale is hard enough when you have, you know, two buyers, and now you introduce, you know, a grantee with the NSP subsidy money into that short sale process. It'll take a little time.
Yeah, good point. Terry?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at it, but I do think that it's harder than doing the REO. So I would say look early to develop a strategy, but recognize that spending a ton of effort to try to make a predisposition workout work may not reap benefits. It may be better just to at least be there, be ready with a productive, you know, takeout upon REO. Because
we'll do another panel here sometime, maybe, Joseph, which is on would buying notes be a better alternative?
Right. I didn't mean when I said agree short sale. Forget short sale. I meant purchase.
We're going to end with another sentence answer, but it's really important. We always want to end on an up note. But what do you believe will be the most promising new development related to neighborhood stabilization, the disposition of REO and other property? When we come back together here with the good graces of the Federal Reserve in another 12 months, what we'll be saying was the fundamental improvement in what we did in that 12-month period. Anybody?
The recipients of NSP 1, 2, and possibly 3 were able to leverage those funds and make a bigger dent than without the leveraging of the funds.
Good one. Anyone else? Jay, you ready?
That's what I was going to say.
Terry?
I'd say that and that organizations that deployed NSP money later in the process will feel better about the effectiveness of where that money went and will not have remorse that a fairly large amount of money slipped through their hands and that they might not have as much tangible evidence of progress from the earlier rounds.
Rob?
Because things are going to get worse, the answers that are right now always no from both investors and servicers, some of them may change to yes.
And I guess I get to go last here. I would just say that as an industry, collectively, through sessions like this and doing the hard work, we'll be more aligned. We'll have a much more common picture of what we need to accomplish to be successful. We will have built a lot of the infrastructure to, in fact, be successful. But, frankly, we'll need a whole lot more money, public and private, to get to the end result. So with that, I apologize, but we're out of time. Thank you for being a good audience. And thank the panelists.